Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to the weekly Manchester United podcast. I'm your host, as always, Phil Branch, on my regular co-host, James. Made a big smile on my face today, which has been on my face all day since yesterday. How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm doing quite well. And how about you?
You know, it's funny because there's few things in life that can make me this happy. I'm sure other people listening to this will know what I mean. It's the other side of the coin. From when you're watching it get annihilated. That 7-0 last season, James, was one of the hardest things I've ever sat through. It was excruciating. And there was such a deluge of reasons to be angry that it couldn't settle on one. But, and it was weird because you had played okay the first half, second half. To lose 7-0 at Anfield was excruciating. And to then feel the other side of that, okay, it was a 4-3. But in some sense, that meant more because of the way United did it. I'll fully admit this. It's been a long time since I've had tears of joy come down my face. But at the when a man scored that goal, I was literally wiping tears on my eyes. My 16-year-old son, 17-year-old son, was doing exactly the same. And there's very few things that can do that to you in life. What that did, it did me yesterday, and I'm still buzzing over it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly unique, you know, and it's like, it's a type of thing where you don't want to sit there and kind of overanalyze why and how and what happens, because it's pure emotion. Same for the players. Same for the crowd, same for everybody involved. It's just pure emotion. And I mean, it's probably the best win in a lot of ways that we've had. I was thinking about it because it's been a long time. When he scored that goal, I let out a sound that was truly astonishing. And I was sitting next to my son who's 5 now. And the last time I made a noise like that was probably when Rashford scored a goal against the penalty against PSG in that knockout. And he was 3 months old at the time, and he was asleep in my arms, and I'd scared the absolute shit out of him at that time. And probably did it again this time. So he's gonna have some trauma to work through from these screens. Yeah, but it was
good luck, man. My kids are used to it now. My 5-year-old comes in and it's like, I don't know how many times she'll say during the game, "Daddy, I don't like it when you yell."
Yeah.
but that was the thing, is that goal, that a mad goal, it wasn't just the win. It was such pent up disappointment from previous United Liverpool games. We never have just been uncompetitive, where you're screaming, going, okay, it's fine if you're not as good, but compete. You know, yes, we'll get to some of the second half in a minute, but the euphoria, the elation, I'm nearly 50 years of age, and when that happens, you feel like a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
You don't have, you know, it's just, like, I mean, you see this video doing the rounds of the FA Cup where, you know, they showed Old Trafford, and if you're not part of, if you don't love football, you don't love this, you can look at it from a distance and go, this makes no sense.
Yeah.
But this is what art is. This is what football is. This is what sport is. This what music is. This is what, you know, paint. There's something abstract about it that moves you in an emotional way that doesn't make any sense. I mean, life itself doesn't make any sense, but it's possible to describe. It's something you have to feel. And to beat Liverpool like that, I'm not exaggerating. It meant so much to me. You know, so many people are struggling with things in their life. The darkness, the sadness, the depression. This is what football is supposed to be. This is the contract you sign when you're a football fan. Is that you're going to have huge emotional lows, and you're going to have some emotional highs if you're lucky. And that makes everything worthwhile. I mean, there's people, we're in America, sometimes people look at me like, you're insane, you know, because it's they just don't understand the, you know, yep. the people that are around me that don't watch football or anything are looking at me. They may think it's funny. They understand they're sport fanatics out here, no question about it. But yeah, it's interesting even watching yourself back later, just how much it moves you. But I can't even begin to tell you how I felt when Ahmad scored that goal.
Yeah, I know it is one of those just kind of indescribables. It's like you float on it for days.
Sometimes I remember I was watching a video the other day, right? My 7-year-old daughter put me in my place very quickly. I was watching an old video of the Beatles. And there was all these, you know, I think it was on the Ed Sullivan Show or something, they come on. And all the girls are screaming their head off, passing out and stuff, you know. And I'm like, why do they have to scream? Why are they passing out? Don't you scream watching football? Didn't you pass out whenever a copy man? Did you pass out watching? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And I did, because the man who scored against Wolves, yeah. I don't know what he passed, and he fell. You know, so, yeah. Don't you? I was like, I suppose she's right. You know, it's something you I haven't grown out of.
For sure, and hopefully never will, because it's very few things that give you that kind of feeling, and I hope to never forget that.
James, what you said is really, really important, because there's a lot of shaming going on for celebration police, or, you know, people our age playing video games and stuff. I'm like, stay young as long as you can.
Yeah,
you don't, you know, what are you supposed, what else are you supposed to be doing as opposed to this? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, enjoy these moments, stay young as you can. And this illusion that there's some level of maturity you have to reach to where you don't do this is insane.
Yeah.
And usually it's a projection from other people who are miserable themselves. And on that very note, one of the thoughts that came to my head after the game was, there are certain negative writers, I don't need to name them, you'll know who I'm talking about. How are they going to find the negative in this? Sure enough, they didn't disappoint. They did.
Yeah.
I assume that's just a personality trait, because it's hard for me to think that anyone could look at that and find darkness. Look, we can talk about the second half performance. We'll get into that. But let me ask you this. What do you think? Do you think we've been here so many times before in the past where this is a turning point, this is a turning point? I don't know if one game can be the turning point, but one of the things I will say in Ten Hag's defense is that when he has players available that understand how to play particular positions, in other words, at a left back, even though Wan-Bissaka is right-footed, he knows how to play fullback. There is a marked difference in improvement in how you need to play.
Yeah, and you know, it's unfortunate in some ways, because we were sat here talking about an emotional win after Brentford, right before an international break as well, that you get 2 weeks, so you don't really get to ride that momentum, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was that one, right? That you don't really get to ride the momentum into a game 3 or 4 days later and go into it, which is fine. You know, I do think that it is hard to say that a game turns things around. We've seen it before. Mm-hmm. Under different managers. It's not a manager-specific thing. It's more complex than that. Life is unfortunately a little more complicated than you might see in a movie where they have one big moment, it turns around and the season goes on from there. And usually that glosses over everything else that has occurred. The thing that I would take away most from this, and that I would like to see if there is to be a turnaround, I don't think it'll be an unconscious thing. Because I think the number one word that I would use for Ten Hag and for the players for this game was that they were brave. The way he set up the team was brave. The way that they approached the game was brave. The way that they attacked it from the off and through extra time was brave. And I think that too often we don't play brave. I mean, against it was really interesting to see that statistically, I saw something there that against Liverpool, the back line was significantly higher against Liverpool than it was against Everton. Just a few games ago, even though we won, it was significantly higher. And you know, against Aston Villa in that comeback game, it was the same thing in the second half. They played very brave. They pushed the lineup. Johnny Evans was playing in that game, diving into, you know, the opponent's half, making tackles. And I think that there's a tendency often to worry, you know, and there's so many reasons for it, that you have to kind of play it safe or to try not to lose, when I think United are a much better team overall, all of them. And this is everybody, right? Because you don't get these kind of, like, if you set up not to lose, you play not to lose. If you play not to lose, you inevitably make decisions that are about not to lose. So it's not just the manager, it's the players, it's everybody together as a team, that I think they're so much better when they play to win entirely. And you know, the fact that there's no draw in a game like this, you get to the end of the game, you get to extra time, you get to all of that, you can't draw, it's win or lose. And that's what makes cup games a little bit more intriguing in that factor. You cannot play for a draw. You cannot be happy with a draw against Liverpool. You've got to win, but you're going to penalties, and then it's a coin flip. And they went for it in every aspect, and they did right in the beginning. And they did things that made Liverpool entirely uncomfortable. One of the things I'd hoped United would do under Ten Hag, because to me it makes a lot of sense, I think I've said this before, even though people don't enjoy this comparison, is when United are at their best, they look like Liverpool. And I thought what they did in that game yesterday, for more of the game, not the second half, there's some bad moments, but for more of the game, they did what Liverpool do better than they did. And that was in the end why they won. Fast, high pressure, high, you know, resilience. They pushed up. They gave them really nothing. They suffocated Liverpool for most of the first half, and into the end of the game and into extra time, they suffocated them in a way that we have not done. And so for me, it's a turning point if they can build on that bravery and make those decisions every game. Let's be brave. You know, Ten Hag talked about treating every game like a final. Well, play it like a final. There's no draw. There's nothing. Win or lose, but be brave.
I think first 35 minutes, you know, dominated the game.
Yeah.
Much better team. Yeah. Really could have had the second goal, should have had the second goal. McTominay probably should have scored. Yes. And we're talking about a completely different game.
Yep.
I felt that Liverpool got the grips with the game. You know, they gave away two really bad goals within 3 minutes. 44 minutes, it's 1-0. You're going up and 1-0 up, and then you're going 2-1 down.
Yep.
And now it's a big test, second half. Are you going to collapse or are you going to fight? And I'll be honest, mate, I remember feeling really angry during the second half, because Liverpool were so in control. You know, we'd get the ball maybe one or two passes, turn it over immediately. Liverpool would hold on to the ball for minutes and minutes and minutes. And it just felt like the third goal was inevitable. And I felt, you know, they get that third or fourth, and this is going to be another embarrassment. And I was thinking, United never do this at Anfield. United can never go there and control a game like this. And truthfully, if I'm Klopp, I'm upset, because Liverpool should have finished United off at 2-1.
Yeah, they almost were lazy about finishing that game.
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple they should have. But United, you know, have done this themselves many times this season, where they don't get the third goal, the killer goal. They let teams back into it. I mean, Anthony to score the way he did, right foot, perfect. And then you need a player. Then it lifted them. The confidence came back into the team. And I know Rashford was probably offside in that moment, but really could have won the game. And then again, they fall behind in extra time. And again, it's a big test. How are you going to respond? Rashford's lovely goal. Took it really well. McTominay, nice pass. And the last goal, one of the things that I don't think has been pointed out enough in this last goal, and obviously United fans are not focusing on this, is just how poor Liverpool were set up.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth do Liverpool end up with a 2-on-1?
Of right?
In the last 10 seconds of the game, all it took was for Harvey Elliott to lose that ball. in the midfield, and United are on top of Liverpool 2-1. I mean, that reminded me of the Sixth here away. You know, I've seen Sunderland United do this against Forest, I think it was, where Klopp didn't get enough criticism from me. You know, that to me is an organizational issue. If I'm sitting there and it's the last minute of the game and we've got a corner, I'm not leaving one man back because of this very issue. And Garnacho does exceptionally well, holds a pass, holds a pass, holds a pass, slips in a mad, and that is not an easy finish, right? I mean, he takes that really, really well. But if I'm a Liverpool fan, and that's, I would be upset. I mean, if Ten Hag did that, where he cautionated the game from leaving one player back, like, look, the corner, maybe you score, but it looks like it's going to go to penalties. But the one thing you don't do is concede from that.
Yep.
And he did. And then, of course, the truly unbelievable. I know it's the rules, but what type of game do you want? You want to send a mad off? He's got a shirt underneath.
Yeah.
Have them take his shirts off at the end of the game. Why is that a second yellow? And I look at Dalot getting sent off at Anfield for something I've never seen happen again, by the way.
Yeah.
And I look at McAllister, who clearly, you know, studs up on Harry Maguire. Bruno Fernandes could have been sent off, although I don't think it was a sending off. When he went to ground, I think it would give a free kick on the edge of the box. Was it Harvey Elliott he went in on? But, you know, I look at that and, like, that really, really poor. I feel sorry for him, Matt. You know, the kid scores an important goal and takes his shirt off. And even the first yellow card was dodgy.
It was. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's sort of an archaic rule. The reasons they even had given for it initially are somewhat ironic, given some of the players who've been yellow carded for it over the years. There were issues over religious concerns and things like that. But I know that Mohamed Salah has been yellow carded a few times for the same thing. It's a funny thing. Overall, it's probably something that needs to change. I mean, at the same time, I'd probably rather not see, you know, you'd have players doing it every time they score a goal if they could get away with it, most likely. But so what? At the end of the day, let them celebrate. Let them have some fun with it.
I really, honestly, even if it was done against United, I don't care.
I wouldn't really care either.
You know, like, I mean, of all the things that are going on in football, to me, you know, okay, if it's excessive, if it's, you know, to me, if they're pulling a shirt off, showing a sponsor or something, or showing something underneath, fine. You know, you should be disciplined for that. But, you know, I think it was, did Luis Diaz do it when his father was kidnapped?
Yeah, something like that, or he had a message under the shirt,
To me, that is where the authorities need to step in and go, look, I know it's hard to nuance that rule, but that, to me, is absurd.
Be reasonable. I know, especially at end of games. It's so ridiculous when you have calls at the end of the games that are, like, completely inconsequential to the game itself, and then result in something stupid happening. But worst case, it adds to Ahmad's the legend of this goal that I think will be remembered for a long time. So
there's so many
be all right.
There's so many positives from yesterday. He's obviously one of them. Anthony's another. Big Maguire, come on, was a colossus, by the way. Absolutely brilliant. You know, put himself about. He was, you know, up front sometimes. He was physical, you know, showed a
confidence. And all man-to-man defending, too. That whole last 50 minutes, all man-to-man defending.
Javi Mainu, once again, showing that this kid is blue chip. Just unbelievable talent. Truly unbelievable. Garnacho, I think that's his 26th start in a row. Once again, showing, I mean, as his brother said, he only had two training sessions leading up to this game due to a hamstring injury. For you to be 19 to start 26 games in a row at that level, with that intensity, is unbelievable. Bruno Fernandes could barely walk by the end of the game. He's playing sweeper. I thought McTominay once again showed, if you judge McTominay on what he can do and not what he can't do, you get a squad player that's chipping in with goals and assists. Regardless of whether he's flashy or not, there's not a lot of players in the Premier League that you can bring in that will do that. And if you compare Scott McTominay's numbers to some of the top midfielders in the Premier League, they compare very favourably. I mean, you know, he scored again, important goal and assist. Rashford took his goal well. Anthony, obviously, like I said, so many positives from yesterday that, you know, I don't know. I think obviously having Wan-Bissaka back is really, really important. So you need to have some balance in the back four.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, that obviously we'll probably see that the rest of the season with Shaw and Malaysia out for the whole year. I think we'll see Wan-Bissaka opposite, you know, Diogo Dalo on the other side for the rest of the season. Certainly, it's a lot better than playing a center back there. And one of the things I did find interesting, I want to mention, sort of because his absence was late announced, right? The night before the game, it was revealed by the Brazilian Football Federation that Casemiro had pulled out a team due to injury. And then, you know, that was obviously confirmed that he's got a muscle injury and that he's not there for the game. And it was kind of interesting because through the game, there was a few times I noted that his absence was probably a positive for certain reasons. United's way of controlling possession and building up through it, you know, oftentimes when Casemiro is playing, what we've seen a lot is a lot of first time balls being launched where he's coming back, taking the ball, launching it first time up down the sides or up forward, and they're losing it and getting a bit more exposed on the counter. And because he wasn't there, instead, Kobbie Mainoo gets on the ball a bit more and was unbelievable, but much, of course, more calm in possession is what he brings to a level that's almost absurd. Dribbling through players, moving the ball around. Possession-wise, I've never seen anything like it from a player of his age. It's incredible. And the other factor was that they spent a lot more time building up through the fullbacks. Wan-Bissaka was really good moving the ball forward in through the left side. I think in the first 35 minutes, United had the ball almost primarily in Liverpool's half on that left side, our left side. With Rashford, with Wan-Bissaka, with all of them. And it really pinned them in there. And so it kind of shows a little bit of a difference, something that maybe needs some adjustment, where when the ball isn't constantly being lost out of the midfield and it's being moved up through the sides, they're better. They retain possession better. Even though we still had some of those midfield gaps, there's a picture obviously that went around that was almost amusing about it. Mm-hmm. I thought that United were a lot better at preventing chances on the break by playing in better areas and losing the ball in less dangerous positions too.
I think you know, one of the things that was a concern for me yesterday was the lack of pressure on the ball. You know, you saw that with McAllister's goal. You saw that. Yeah. Harvey Elliott's goal, where they're picking the ball up 20, you know, you see the shipment of shots United can see, where they're picking the ball up, they have time to control, lift their head, take a shot before there's any pressure on the ball. That's a big concern.
Yep.
I think there's gaps between the defense and midfield, because I think Ten Hag is concerned that the defense doesn't have a lot of pace, so they sit deeper, and so they're afraid. You know, I don't know if this was exactly the issue yesterday, because as you were saying, they played a higher line, but typically what you'll see is a lower block from United when the midfield presses, there's this big gap because the defense is sitting deep because they're afraid of being done for pace. This is something they're definitely going to have to fix. But I think you have to also consider teams. Ten Hag lost two games since the start of the year. Mm-hmm. One of those was City away. And there's no question, like I was saying earlier, that when he has a fit football team, not football players, right? Football team. Players that are capable of playing the way he wants to play. That are capable of executing the way he wants to play. United have looked significantly better. I mean, his record against Liverpool is really, really good. So his two wins, a draw and one defeat. The one defeat, of course, was this, you know, 7-0, which was a nightmare. He beat City at home last season, beat Arsenal at home last season, and beat Barcelona at home last season. I mean, when United have a fit squad, you know, they're capable of beating anyone on their day. And, you know, he's in his second season. in two seasons. One, he had no striker for most of last season. No central striker once Ronaldo left. Two, he's had no left back for most of this season. I mean, that is an unbelievable handicap at this level. And if he gets United to another cup final, which you would have to say stands a really good chance, that would have meant that in two seasons, finished third, League Cup final, two FA Cup finals. I mean, considering the chaos that's going on at United, is it fair to expect more than that?
Given everything, I think the league position is still probably an important factor in that, because, you know, cup runs are, I mean, look, it's not to discredit it. The cup runs are important. They're vital. I think they're very, very good as well for young teams that are trying to build something to get somewhere and to get something out of it. But you look at Chelsea, there are, in the semifinals as well. Of course, they play City. They have caused them a lot of problems. They're interestingly one of the few teams that have been very, very good against City. And they have a chance of beating them, which would be very nice, because I reckon our chances against Chelsea are much higher in a final than City. But their league position is terrible right now, right? They're doing really poor in the league. I don't know if you can expect more. I don't know if you can. I think there's things you can expect more out of, for sure. I think that, you know, given that Ten Hag will 100% be here through the end of the season, 100%, he will be here through the end of the season, and likely, of course, a cup final at the end of it. I think he has a chance here to show that, because Lisandro Martinez will be back after the break. Wan-Bissaka is in and is a competent player in that left back position. That means you have almost a fully healthy back line and a very good one at that. Lisandro Martinez, Ferran, Maguire, all available. Dalot, Wan-Bissaka. That's good. I think the biggest question mark comes down to, you know, the midfield aspects of it and how he sets that up, especially with Mason Mount also returning now too. Because one of the problems you have is with the midfield gaps is that it's almost I don't know how you solve it, the issue here, because Scott McTominay is playing where he's playing and you need his goals, but you're still lacking, like you said, somewhat of a combative midfielder that's closing players down and doing that. It was an interesting thing, because the in possession was better with Casemiro, and out of possession, you saw issues with not closing players down and not applying enough pressure. So, you know, I think Ten Hag will get a good chance here to, after the international break, to show what we can do in the league and win the games we need to win in the league to climb back. The door is open, you know, to climb back into fourth or fifth position. And I think fifth will get Champions League based on the results we saw the last week. They were very favorable for the English clubs. I think it's like 80% or something again now. They will get a chance. Villa have a lot of injuries. Villa are dropping points. Tottenham are dropping points. Yeah, and they both have really tough. I think they both have slightly tougher runs than United, who have a few tough ones. But it's not so much the tough games I'm worried about. I think that what's important for Ten Hag and for this team, they can't be losing the games against Brentford. They can't be losing those types of games. Those are the ones, the Fulham games, right? Those are the ones, the losses that haunt you. Those are the ones that cannot lose. And I think that we have a chance here to see a fair judgment of what they can do as a team moving forward. And I think we have a good chance if they can do that. And that's why I say again that the biggest thing I would hope for is that they're brave moving ahead, because they got to approach Brentford, to me, with as much intensity and in the same way that they approach this Liverpool game, you know, not sitting back, not hoping you don't lose, not just go and imprint what you want to do on them. Because if they can reproduce the way that they played that first 35 minutes against a team like Brentford, then they will dominate them over 90 minutes and win. And they will do that against a lot of teams. And then they have Liverpool at home again. April 7th, you know, in a league game. And that's a big one too, to show this. I'm not saying they have to win it to prove it, but that's what I would really like to see. Is I'd like to see that we can make something happen, you know, in and really through the end of the year, because I think you could, and I think it would be a fairer measure of where things are at overall.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously with Ahmad, Anthony both playing well, it's going to be interesting to see how he fits those into the team. And with Ahmad, you could play him centrally. I was listening to Tony Mowbray talk about this when he had him at Sunderland, how he played a lot of times in a false nine position. Problem is you have Bruno Fernandes in there. Ten Hag needs luck with injuries, James, for the last quarter of the season.
Yep.
If he can get a break with injuries through the last quarter of the season, he has a chance. Injuries have no doubt been a major factor on what is going on this season. I'm not saying, you know, try to be fair on the show where we've criticised Ten Hag where we feel it's worthy, but also defended him where we feel that he deserves to be defended. And this is the problem, is that you can create a strong narrative about Ten Hag either way. You should probably be man an argument no matter what. But I fear that if you know, if he gets in to a cup final and finishes top four, he should be in the job next season. No question, in my opinion. I think that would be realistic with expectations, you know, of United, considering, you know, how depleted that squad is. And the thing is that the players that come in, for the players that are injured, are not players that are capable of playing the way Ten Hag wants his teams to play. Liverpool have had years and years and years of building a squad, of recruiting players, compound interest on that, where someone comes out, the player that's coming in is capable of playing the way Klopp wants, or they wouldn't be there. United don't have that yet. You know, that's going to take a few years completely committing to a manager and building a squad in that image. So it's not easy when you're playing Victor Lindelof at left back. So we'll see what happens with Ahmad. Very, very encouraging to see him score. And of course, Anthony, hopefully they get some momentum from this. We also want to talk about signings and some other things before I finish up on the Liverpool thing. One really disappointing thing from yesterday is the tragedy chanting.
Yeah.
I know it's not exclusive to United. Just, you know, lots of fans do this, but I never understand how grown men can stand there and taunt other human beings about people dying. And as much as I love this football, this sport and this rivalry, you know, to me, you know, you look at something like Hillsborough, I know they sing about Munich. Many of them don't, but some do. It is, to me, depravity beyond belief that you would find some humour or something that's worth, you know, a rivalry that's worth you compromising human values to the point where you would mock people who have died, and people that died at Hillsborough were just a lot of young kids. It is despicable. And I remember last year, I think it was the League Cup final, some idiot wore a shirt saying 96 was not enough. And they're a permanent embarrassment to the football club. This does not make you more of an uber United fan. It doesn't, it just makes you a fucking idiot.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously, I think it's something that occurs a lot more with, you know, in the locality, obviously, things like that. But it's one of those things I've, you know, that people get way, they get over the top on, and it happens in a lot of sport, less so than it used to, fortunately, you know, in terms of things. I mean, you see things like in the Turkish league, the fans coming on the field and attacking the players yesterday. Like, it's out of control, those types of things. They're utterly ridiculous.
Michy Batshuayi's
he did a good one, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they held their own. Those Fenerbahce players are, I wouldn't, you know, they really held their own against the crowd there.
I was probably his career highlight, but go ahead.
Yeah, you know, they did hold their own, but, you know, those are the types of things, because that's what it stems, that's what it gets into when you allow those types of rivalries to spawn far beyond what they should be. And it happens in other leagues with a lot of racial things and things like that, that of course make absolutely no sense, given that they usually have players of the same race on their own team. But there's no logic to it. And yeah, it's absolutely something that just should stay entirely out of the sport in general, 100%. There's no excuse for it in any respect, no matter who's playing. no matter who. There's a lot of respect between clubs over the things that have happened at the club level and at the player level, over the things that have occurred, over the tragedies that have happened. And, you know, there's no need for the fans, for any fans, to create something that isn't there.
What's interesting to me is every time I see these videos and I hear this happen, I'm always thinking it's some young kid or something, some young teenager. And I saw it with City a couple of weeks ago doing the, you know, the European Munich chants, and it's always some grown 45-year-old. I'm like, well, you know, what do you, I mean, have you got a you know, brain injury or something? What the fuck is wrong with you? Why would you reach that? I mean, I don't understand how a brain can think, you know what I want to do here? I'm going to mock people that get killed. I don't get it. I don't get it, mate. I don't, it's a level I don't want to go to, or I can enjoy the referee and it's intense. I had an amazing burst of emotion yesterday, but that's a level that I don't think is something that anyone should be doing. And it certainly doesn't do anything to project an image that you're some type of Uber United fan. It just makes you an idiot. Okay, let's move on. I know that you had some transfer info that you wanted to get into, so I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, it's mid-March, obviously, and, you know, the way that United approach things and the way that they run things over the course of the year is around this time, and I think, as I know from past experience at least, that during this, especially this international window period of this time, is when they're really starting to work on things for the future. And there'd been a lot of questions. Well, how are they going to approach things? How are they going to do this when they don't have these individuals in place? But the fact of the matter is there's still a lot of people who are at Manchester United right now that are entrusted with doing these things with different leadership in place. And so they've been already in contact with things. The way I see it, they really want to get a fast start on this summer. There is no time to waste. And when you're dealing with the financial issues that United have to deal with, the rules and limitations that they're up against, one of the biggest reasons for that and one of the biggest ways that you end up spending too much money is by waiting and taking too long and making those purchases late in the window. That's where United have been terrible, where they've made the biggest mistakes and where they've overspent the most on players that they could have had for significantly less earlier in the window. So that is one of the basic errors that, you know, the new leadership at United want to take care of by being extremely proactive on this. Obviously, you saw in the last week, Murtaugh and Matt Hargreaves touring a bit around Europe, forming relationships with, we discussed that on the last show, forming relationships and talking about things and certainly discussing sales. And potential, you know, being proactive on the selling front. But they're also very much being proactive on starting discussions over, you know, in contacts with players over potentially joining United. There's a lot of different stages that this goes through. They've made contact with players such as, you know, with their representatives of Gerard Braithwaite, Michael Olise. And they're really starting to line up the positions of need for the summer. And over the after this next few weeks during the international break, it will start to ramp up. They want to meet players. They want to start actually working on these deals between April and May. So as soon as the window is open, they're ready to actually, you know, get those kind of transfers done. And it doesn't matter in a lot of respects. First of all, that Dan Ashworth is not there. He's not really the boots on the ground recruitment person. David Ornstein made a good point on this. And how he described him, that I think people should think with it. He's a club builder. He's not somebody who comes in and is like, oh, I want that player. Let's get that player. And that's how you identify it. That's in a lot of ways the error that United are trying to move away from, where your recruitment process is solely driven by a singular person's opinion or their final say, you know, where it's too much. There's a lot of people that there's a huge, I mean, United has a massive, robust scouting department. A huge, massive, robust analytics department that's being built on more with good people. And it's about properly organizing administratively how these channels pass information along, how decisions are made, and they're working on it. And so they're starting to kind of make those decisions. They definitely are interested, as I gather, in the right wing position, potentially.
Yeah, I don't understand, though. If Elise is a right winger, James,
Yeah.
Garnacho would appear to me to have the right wing spot locked down. They still aren't Nuno Mad out there. Why?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, obviously on the one hand, Anthony and Ahmad have played, Ahmad's played a total now of 45 minutes, right? And as exciting as it is, it's a little, this is where it's a little bit hard to make those kind of decisions. I think Ahmad in the end probably will be better. There were some signs of this at Sunderland, but maybe better not as a winger, but as somebody who comes a bit more into the midfield, in fact, from a possession standpoint, playing as almost a 10 or even in that kind of Bernardo Silva role of a right center mid. You know, and then Anthony, you know, they can't really make decisions based as of this point in time. They can't look at it and say, yeah, he's a player we can rely on.
But even if they leave, you've still the Garnacho problem. At least he's not a backup right winger. And they're not going to accept.
But it's too many games. It's too many games. I mean, like we talked about, Garnacho's played 26 games in a row, started, right? At this point. Yeah, well, these are the questions we don't know, right, overall, for sure, and how it all builds together. They have only three forwards they can rely on. And obviously, that is not enough. You look at Liverpool, you look at City and how they play. Jack Grealish was 100 million. He doesn't start every game, but he can still be at times a key player.
But
yeah, of course.
That would mean that they've already made decisions about Anthony. They've already made decisions where they've decided no matter what happens, between, even if you go on this amazing run of scoring goals, playing exceptional, you're out, no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, they can always back up on a deal and not follow through with it. But at the point, but this is the issue that you have with football in general and transfer planning. It starts way before summer, and these have to be long term decisions.
That confuses me is when you have FFP, PSR, whatever restrictions, be very careful about where you buy players.
Mm-hmm.
I bought Jadon Sancho, and I still don't understand why, because when Solskjaer's coming out saying his best position's on the left, well, he's not a backup to Rashford, so why did you sign him? You know, remember at one point, Dortmund were asking for like 110 million for Sancho, right? And we still don't know why they bought Van de Beek, right?
Yep.
And I'm looking at these and going, you needed one central striker.
Mm-hmm.
Do they need another right winger? Because, I mean,
I think they 100% do. I mean, look, Garnacho's only played half a season at right wing, though. You know, he still can play on the left.
I would say that's his best position now. If he's going to play in a United, he's going to play right wing. So, if you need to turn around and take Garnacho next season and start playing him, you know, he's 20, like I said, started 26 games. Next season, you're only going to start 20 games. I mean, they're going to find that very difficult, because it's very difficult to go backwards with a player and say, I know you started all these games last season, but this season you're not. You know,
because
around usually as they get better and better, they play more and more games.
Yep.
I agree that they need another right winger, but you know, I'm reading reports Palace are going to ask 60-70 million for a lease and all that. I mean, I'm sorry, like I can think of so many. They need a left back, they're going to need another center back, in my opinion. They're going to need another midfielder because Casemiro will probably leave. I mean, these to me are far more
important. No, and those are positions, but you have to think you've got three forward positions, and you play between 50 and 60 games in a year. That means you have 150 to 180 games available. Right now, you're losing a huge amount of quality the moment you don't start one of the current front three. But if you average 160 games for three players up front, which I think is about the average for top six clubs in general, then you'd want to give four players about 40 starts. That would be ideal if none of them get injured and there's no injuries at any point in time. I don't think it's sustainable. What's that? 160 between the three. Because you have three positions, right? Because you have three positions. So my point being is you split them up especially with wingers, they can be flexible as to sides and how they move. And Rashford moves down the middle here and this person moves there. You have, you know, when I've looked at, you know, City during a lot of their campaigns, when you measure the way that they use their forwards, they would often have between their forwards about 160 games played. and they'd be splitting it among four or five players almost evenly in the end. By the end of the season, it would be almost equal. And the drop-off in quality was minimal when they would be changing in between those five. And so, yeah, 100% they need a striker, 100%. And this is where the, you know, the problem lies in all of this, is that you need so many things, but you still have to kind of start somewhere. And hopefully get as much done as they possibly can. And sales will be a huge factor in that. If you can get, because yes, the priorities are a winger, a backup striker, because you can't buy a striker, a now starting level striker, right? You're not buying another one to compete with Hoyland there. Realistically, that wouldn't make sense either. You need two midfielders, potentially two center backs. Obviously, the futures of all these players is not totally firmed up when it comes to Maguire, Varane. You need, you know, there's still questions to be asked on the fullback side of things, because if Wan-Bissaka comes back and continues to play like that, are you buying a right back? Diogo Dalot is essentially unreplaceable, where earlier in the year you probably were looking at a right back. Now you're not. So the priorities definitely will shift, but they have to plan for all of these things. They don't necessarily have to execute, right? If they say, hey, yeah, the next 15 games, it's worked out great. Right wing becomes not a position, you know, Antony goes on a tear and is scoring a bunch of goals, that changes the priorities of, you know, these lists and these short lists and these positions that we're building all these players out. But they have to line them up, because there's no guarantee of any of that occurring.
So are we saying Branthwaite or two they're looking at? Yeah, I mean, we know that they really like Branthwaite, right? Yep. Are we saying Branthwaite? Who else we got?
Well, so yeah, when it comes to the midfield, there was names we've talked about before in terms of Palacios, Onana at Everton. And at center back, there's a lot of names to, in addition, right, to Branthwaite. There's Gonzalo Inacio. There is Toribio, obviously, at Nice, they've talked about. Tapsoba at Leverkusen. At fullback, I don't think anybody really has an idea, because this left back situation was a bit unexpected. Right. You didn't really expect at the start of the year, after buying Malaysia, to have him be missing for 12 months and Luke Shaw to be out for the season. So there's a lot more, I think, that's been done in terms of center backs, given that Varane is departing in summer and you have the situations with Maguire and Lindelof. But,
is Varane, you know, those are departing in summer?
Well, that's an interesting thing, too, right? Because right now he's a free agent in summer. He could sign with anybody. At any point in time right now outside of England, he could sign a pre-contract with any club in Europe right now if he wanted to. He hasn't yet. So I think it's a little bit up in the air. And they certainly have an issue on their hands, because like you've talked about with these random signings in the past, there's been no plan for signing these players. It's always been some random reason they've signed this player or this player, because they're a talent, because they want them, because they like them. And it's kind of a complex puzzle, I think, you know, United's transfer strategy moving forward and trying to correct it. And it's going to take a few years to fix it. There is no doubt about that, that it's not going to be fixed in one summer because of these kinds of questions. Is Rafael Varane going to stay? Do they want him to stay? How long would you sign him for at this point in time? He's actually, funnily enough, been healthier this year now than he's been in most of the years past in recent, but can you rely on that moving forward? So it's complex, but I'm quite positive they're going to sign at least one center back, at least one midfielder, and very likely one to two forwards, you know, as well to kind of round things out. But very complicated situation to think with. I know, and that is a problem, but you're also going to have to sell them then, you know, or loan, right? Potentially, like we talked about last time, I think send Malaysia out on loan and sign a left back is probably our best bet, I would imagine.
One of the things that I thought was quite interesting when I was reading the financials on Thursday or Friday was that United really could have spent in January if they'd have wanted, and still being more than compliant with FFP, yet Erik ten Hag was not allowed to bring anyone in, a striker or any other position. In fact, I think the financial motivation was probably the main reason why they let Reguilón go, and that they just didn't want to carry an extra wage they didn't feel they had to. So they acted with a bit of a parsimony that wasn't from what I could see, that necessarily they did have some room in January, but still chose not to spend.
Yeah, and I think they could spend quite a bit this summer at the end of the day when you look at where it's kind of heading with some of the things that they're clearing out. I think they can. I think, you know, in one factor, obviously, Ineos would have been wary of any long-term decisions being made on players and purchases ahead of them really getting their feet in and all of that. Some of the things they're going to have to be sorted out, just a couple of other names to just kind of discuss that I want to bring up, because you have the Jadon Sancho situation with Dortmund, where they don't want to pay over 30 million or something like that for him. They do want to sign him, but they don't want to pay, over 30 million.
Well, that's pretty much what they've been paying for players. Dortmund's at 35 million mark for the last, number of years.
Yep. And there's another fact.
Cost more than that. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. And one of the players that I mentioned this a long time ago that is still on offer is Daniel Malen. Mm-hmm. And when you kind of talk about, Ten Hag and the future, this is an area that needs resolution. And I'm not going to pick on him. There was an art, there was two articles that came out from someone who's really close to him and his agency, SEG, which is a Simon Muluk at the Mirror, who's had a lot of information that's come out of his area from the start since Ten Hag has arrived. And it was this whole story about the new Ajax CEO, I think is an SEG client or something like that, and about the potential coaches that could go there and things. But there's two stories that have come out in the last few weeks from him about Ten Hag. And one of them was talking about how he might want to depart depending on how much power he's given in these areas and depending on how much money he's given to spend. And I'm not going to take this literally in a sense, right, to say, anything except those are real stories from someone close to him and close to his agency. And one of the conflicts that I've mentioned for a long time is this point of them needing to really sort those agreements out, regardless of where they finish, of where he's going to stand moving forward as to his position and what level of influence and power he will have, because it will be diminished should he stay regardless. And having to accept that. And it comes into specific situations like this. Daniel Malen is a player who's been offered by Dortmund to United on a few occasions recently. It's not a player they want, but Ten Hag would like him as a replacement for Jadon Sancho and as part of a make weight. He's a Dutch player. His agency also happens to be SEG. I'm not making an implication beyond that, except it is a player that Ten Hag wants that fits the mold of the players he's liked, that he's had more experience with, more connection with, and all of that. But it's not a player that the club would pursue. They're going to have to resolve these types of things, no matter what, moving forward. If he stays, those types of things will have to be resolved. Ideally, in a situation where they're not signing players that they're not convinced of, with agreement from the manager. And that's just kind of an example of that has to occur. And I don't know what to think necessarily of the articles that come out like that. It's been somebody who has written really good sourced information for him. So I don't want to knock it and just say that it's, someone causing trouble, because that's not really been the nature of that individual's articles. I don't really know what to make of it. I understand the complication that goes into all of this, coming into this. And this is why with new owners, you tend to get replacements, because you have disagreements over these types of things. But it's certainly something that will need to be resolved. And my expectation is that over the next few weeks, there will be a lot of discussions about this as they get into the transfer swing of things. And they really do have to come to a head on it. And it's also why I firmly believe, as you've said, and I agree with this as well, that his future has to be resolved sooner than the end of the season. And it should be known and understood sooner than the end of the season, because there's so many things they have to do to make this a good summer and to make it a good next season, that they have to resolve these factors on all sides. It's complicated. Yeah. It's a bit of a tangle to sort out.
No, you can't plan for next season not being committed to a manager.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said before, next season starts now.
Yeah.
Starts March. I do think United will act with a level of efficiency that we haven't seen. Be interesting to see what ends up happening with Ashworth. I would imagine, with being the international window, we'll probably get some movement on a few of those hires, Jason Wilcox, everything else. We'll start to see some of that, really, those pieces starting to fall into place. It was also interesting that Ratcliffe paid off the revolving credit facility, paid it down significantly, which, you know, was something that it was supposed to do in the summer, chose not to do for obvious reasons. But instead of putting it towards Old Trafford, they decided that this was high interest debt and it needed to be cleared. And Ratcliffe has gone some significant distance to paying that off. So I think we'll leave it there. I mean, I don't think we've got much else. Is there anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I think that just on that last point, I think it is an interesting indication of the thought process, because obviously it looks like a new stadium. You know, the 120 million is not really going to do anything for that new stadium, right? That's not what it's going to accomplish. And so I think that obviously the goal is really, really focused on getting United as a football club with all the funds available, getting United as a football club performing to the highest level. And I think that would make it a lot easier to get the funding, the backing, and sorting things out for things like a new stadium. If United were performing to the level that they should on the pitch, it's going to help with all of that. And so I think that's kind of the consideration at this point, is let's put every dollar that we have into getting United back on the pitch to where it should be. And that's going to allow us to do so much more off the pitch as well. And I think I agree with that.
Yeah. Before you invest in the theater, you have to invest in the show. Fantastic result yesterday, international break. So we may or may not be back next week. We'll see what happens. If there's stuff to cover, we'll see. Nice way to go into the break. Fantastic result for United. Very positive, and probably watch those highlights, I don't know, hundreds of times already. But
easily.
All right. Take it easy, folks. Thanks, James. See you later.
See you later. Thank you.
Take it easy. Bye.